It's time to meet Bildad. You ready? Okay. I warned you. I did. Okay. His Excellency, the Pope, met with his cardinals to discuss a proposal from Ariel Sharon, who happened to be at the time the leader of Israel. Your Holiness, said one of the cardinals, Mr. Sharon wants to challenge you to a game of golf to show the friendliness and ecumenical spirit shared by the Jewish and Catholic faith. I don't know where she got that picture, but oh wow, that was Janet got that. The Pope thought that, wow, this is a good idea, but the Pope had never played golf before. Don't we have a cardinal who can represent me? None that plays very well, the cardinal replied. But, he added, there's this man named Jack Nicklaus. He's an American golfer who's also a devout Catholic. We can offer to make him a cardinal and then ask him to play with Mr. Sharon as a personal representative. In addition to showing the spirit of cooperation, we shall also win the match. Everyone agreed that it was a very good idea. The call was made. Of course, Nicholas was greatly honored, and he agreed to play on the Pope's behalf. The day after the match, Nicholas reported to the Vatican. I have some good news and some bad news, Your Holiness, said the golfer. Well, tell me the good news first, Cardinal Nicholas. And, well, Your Holiness, I don't like to brag, but even though I played some pretty terrific rounds of golf in my life, this was by far the best round of golf I have ever played. I must have been inspired from above. My drives are long and true. My irons are accurate and purposeful. And my putting was perfect. With all due respect, my play was truly miraculous. There's bad news, the Pope said. Yes, Nicholas replied. I lost to Rabbi Tiger Woods by 3 strokes. Does she have a picture of Tiger? No. Okay. We humans, we are hardwired, I think, to think about things as being fair. And children learn this very on in life, demanding an equal share of whatever is being doled out to any punishment that's being delivered. If we watch TV on sports, we end up yelling at the TV when the refs do not seem to be applying the rules fairly to both teams. Actually, in particular, fairly to our favorite team. How often have you heard from people of all ages, that's not fair? But fairness is also the underpinnings of our ideas about the fact that God is just. The idea of God being just and fair was the worldview of Job's 3 friends. It's also, believe it or not, the framework of the religion of Islam and all other monotheistic religions. Now, Eliphaz, we met last week, he was trying really hard to be gentle with Job. He really was. But Bildad, he is angry. His words have a harshness to them. Bildad has become antsy sitting there. Remember, they're sitting on the ground listening to Job. Not because he's tired of intellectual debate, but he sees Job's words in his response or his words to be empty and useless. They're nothing but hot air, Bildad says. God is fair, Bildad argues. It's the truth of the universe, he says. Cruelly, Bildad argues that Job's children died because they had sinned. Can you imagine how hurtful words like that are? Bad things happen to bad people, Bildad says. You'll remember the story of Ananias and Sapphira in Acts chapter 5 and how they lied before the company of the church and ended up dying. But these words are very hurtful to a man who's lost all his children And it ignores the fact that Job, for many years, had been sacrificing for each of his children. He tried to atone for the acts of his children. But this doesn't matter to Bildad. Sacrifice does nothing. There's no such thing as redemptive suffering, in Bildad's opinion. And Bildad goes on to sort of rub salt in the wound by saying, well, things are bad for you, but at least you're still alive. Therefore, you're not as great a sinner as your children are. Oh, man. Even now, Bildad argues, if Job turns to God and repents, everything will be restored. The words used here are rightful habitation. In other words, everything will go back to the way it was. Bildad's system or worldview is black and white. It's a cold reality. And it's familiar, isn't it? There's no place for grace in Bildad's well-ordered universe. And to prove his point, Bildad goes on and references the system to the way things were in the past. As long as people have pondered these things, he says, they've concluded the same answer. And then he goes on and gives two illustrations to prove his point. The first is negative, and it's from nature. Papyrus reeds, he says, need marshy areas in which to grow. They cannot flourish where there's no water. If you cut down flowers, they will wither before the planted ones. This is just like Job's children. They are cut down in their prime. Can you just feel the pain that Job must be experiencing? Job is like a reed that has been moved away from the sustaining water. These are the paths of those who forget God, Bildad says. Those who do not realize these truths are living on something as flimsy as a spiderweb. The second illustration is also from nature, but has a bit of a positive twist. A truly righteous person is like a plant that thrives by sending shoots out into the garden and entwining around rocks. Even if the plant is destroyed, it will spring up again. Bildad is saying with this illustration, if you had been truly blameless before God, Job, then even the most devastating events that you experience, you will bounce back with full vigor. In God's fairness, Job's circumstance, according to Bildad, is just a setback. Wow. I really hope you see the coldness of what Bildad is saying. Good people are blessed. Bad people are cursed. Clearly, your life is evidence of which you are, Job. Not very consoling, is it? Job's response then to Bildad is an honest grappling of a believer with God. When a person's worldview, remember, Job believed the same as his friends, but now he can't reconcile it. His worldview is crumbling around him. In some ways, Job is right in what he says, and in other ways, he's wrong. But that's the nature, isn't it, of wrestling for the truth. In trying to understand the very character of God, he cannot reconcile God's character with his actions. Job knows that everything comes from God's hand. He said that right at the beginning, didn't he? And Job's flawed conclusion is that the unfairness he experiences means God is unjust. Those are hard things to hear. So the main point of his dialogue is, who or what is the causation of bad things in a person's life? In chapter 1 and 2, we got a glimpse of this design, but Job didn't get that insight, did he? Is there a sinister agency behind all these bad things? You know, in 1 Chronicles 21, we read that David, King David, undertook a census against God's direction. God told him not to do it. We read that Satan stood against Israel and incited David to take the census. But The chronicler does not suggest that Satan did it of his own volition. The use of other agents to do terrible things is all part of the larger plan for the glorification of God. It's something Job cannot see, nor his friends, and frankly, neither do we. Job's experience points out that the world isn't fair. Bad things do happen to good people. Jesus said that the rain falls on the just and the unjust alike. Job roots out a major flaw in Bildad's argument. How can any mortal being be truly justified before God? And yet, as we see time and time again, Job is struggling. It's his primary goal to get right with God. Those who worship idols long for what that idol promises. Maybe your idol, you pray to it because you want a good harvest, or you want lots of children, or you want lots of money, etc., etc. Job, though, cares about none of that. Job longs for God. The problem is he can see no way to achieve that connection to God. God is too far beyond him, too hard to understand. It's too hard to stand before God and succeed. It can't be done, Job says. Job then goes on to paint quite a picture of the natural order being disrupted in his life, of it being turned upside down. Mountains and pillars of the earth are shaken. In Psalm 75, verse 3, God says, "When the earth totters and all its inhabitants, it is I who keeps it steady." Job acknowledges that God is the creator, God is the sustainer of all there is, but now it seems this same order is now in a disorder, at least from his perspective. Job is strongly beginning to hint that God is the maker, but hold on, these are Job's words, but God is also the troublemaker. That's what he thinks. The light has been replaced by darkness, he says. In this grand creation of God's, there are evil things and there are disordered things all around us. It is not perfect. Not only that, Bildad, Job says, there is a greater problem than even this. God is invisible. Which means God's elusive. H.G. Wells wrote in his book, The Invisible Man, "He can pass by me, move on, and come close to me to do me harm, like snatching my children or possessions and my children. And I cannot see him. I am no match for him." That's how Job feels. God is too strong for us. It's absolutely absurd to think that we can prevail over God. God would just crush us like that whirlwind that killed Job's children. He would knock us down and take away our breath. In God's court, my speech is like shouting into a hurricane. The blameless and the wicked are both subject to terrors and destruction, Job says. Job's conclusion is simple then. Are you ready for this? Remember, it's his conclusion, not mine. God is not fair. If both the blameless and the wicked suffer, how is that fair? Job says God actually laughs at the calamity falling upon the innocent. Wow. Those are really hard words to hear, aren't they? The earth is given over to unjust people committing unjust acts, Job says. Job is pained by realizing that if God is truly sovereign, then all this injustice is also from him. Wow, that's hard. He has nowhere else to go with his conclusions. Despite what his friends think, despite what we think. So Job proposes three solutions to his problem. He can simply deny that he is suffering. That's the solution. He can put on a happy face and move on. This is what many people have desired to do or encourage others to do when they're in the midst of a grief. Forget the pain. Keep a stiff upper lip, we are told. It is a strategy, as I said, that's employed by many people today. You just deny that there's a problem or deny that we are in pain. I've said this so many times. You ask anyone how they are. Anyone. And they're bound to reply not with the truth. All they say is, fine, thank you. Really? His second idea is to try once again to make himself clean before God. He's been trying this. Washing with snow carries the idea of purity, not whether snow is better than water, that doesn't matter. But Job despairs of this idea because he is convinced that no matter how clean he is, God is determined to prove him dirty. The reference to a pit and his stinky clothes conveys that point to us. And then, wow, this is really important. I've been hinting at this all along. Then Job lands on the one idea that has great potential for all of us. What Job thinks he needs is a mediator between himself and God. Someone who knows the rules in God's courtroom. You know anybody like that? But this too, at least in Job's mind, is kind of an empty wish. Remember, this is before the cross. There is no one for whom Job can turn to intercede for him, but we have someone. But behind all these futile ideas is one lingering reality. Every time Job gets knocked down in his thinking, his hope grows stronger. His sense that someday he may once again relate to God is growing each and every moment in that suffering. Job sums up his reply to Bildad with three questions directed right at God. First, why are you against me? Eliphaz and Bildad's explanations don't give a satisfactory answer to that question. And then Job asks the question, why do you watch me? In chapter 7, Job describes God as a hostile watcher. And he returns to that theme in chapter 10. If God was human, he could understand the need to really observe and check out Job, but God knows everything. God knows his heart, so why bother watching him? It seems so unnecessary for God to treat him like this. And then he returns to a very familiar question. Why did you create me in the first place? Job poetically describes God carefully putting him together like Adam, or like Jeremiah talks about, taking unconnected matter and knitting it together. In such a complex creature, Job ponders, why did you bother to make me? What a creative act is each conception, gestation, and birth, he says. Not only did you make me, but you granted me life and steadfast love, but this too has led to heartache. Verse 13 states, this was your purpose. It's very, very hard to hear Job in his pain, to talk like this. Job says, you give the appearance of being a loving creator, but you hid it in your heart, he says. The cruel intentions that are now worked out in Job's life are beyond reckoning. Job sees three things that God does. God renews his witness against Job. Every disaster says that Job is under judgment. Second, that God increases his vexation against Job. Far from being slow to anger, God seems to be quite quick at it. Then Job points out that wave upon wave of fresh troops, like a siege army, are besetting him. God, Job says, is pouring trouble upon trouble. So Job goes back to an earlier refrain. Why don't you just kill me? Get it over with. Just leave me alone for a moment's peace. Soon I will die. I will go to the land of the dead. Let me alone until then, Job says. Now, we may be unsettled by Bildad's position, but we are probably more so by Job's response. We likely rankle at the things Job has said, the accusations he has leveled against God, and maybe the accusations he's leveled against all mankind. However, despite the fact that Job depicts God as kind of a monster here, his intensity of argument reveals that Job has not reached the end of his searching. Job still longs for connection with God, still longs for meaning. Reflecting on Job's words, we may cringe at the depth of his anger, especially his anger towards God. But how many of us have also tread a path like that? You've been wronged, you've been hurt, you've been cheated, and you are angry at God. Whatever negative thing that's happened in your life may leave you feeling like God doesn't care for you, or wondering why he didn't intervene when he should have. You wonder how you could possibly trust God. Isn't he supposed to love you? Maybe you're not sure he even exists anymore. You know, it's okay to question the trials that you or someone you love is going through. Throughout history, people have struggled to understand why these things happen. Even people in the Bible like King David and Moses and Habakkuk the prophet didn't hesitate to tell God how they felt. David wrote very famously, Psalm 89 verse 46, "How long, Lord, will you hide yourself from me? Will you keep your anger keep burning like fire?" Or the prophet Habakkuk cries out, "How long, Lord, must I call for help, but you do not listen, or cry out to you violence, but you do not save?" And Moses, he's leading that group of complaining Israelites to their homeland. He says to God, "Why have you brought this trouble on your servant? What have I done to displease you?" These great biblical figures that we revere weren't immune to feelings of injustice. And they were honest about their feelings. But they also, every one of them, acknowledged that God is holy and that his ways are above our ways. You know, anger is a valid reaction to hardship. It really is. But when it's left unchecked, it can lead to hostility and bitterness that can eat you from the inside out. That's why the Bible says in Ephesians 4:26, "Be angry and do not sin." Because if you give anger a foothold, it can lead to all kinds of terrible things. The burden you bear, the problem you face, the affliction that you cannot shake, it may be painful. It might be overwhelming and frustrating. Whatever it is, there's nothing wrong with telling God all about it. In fact, here's a surprise, he already knows anyway. Just be sure you're not consumed by your anger, that you cannot see the hand of God at work even in your suffering. I am really moved by something Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote, and I hope that it stays with me for the rest of my life. He wrote, "Even in the mud and the scum of things, something always, always sings." So I ask you, what sings for you when life gets hard?